Well, thank you very much, Professor, and I'm very honored to be here at a conference that itself is given in honor of my friend Robert George's fine first book, Making Men Moral. And it's an inspiration to be on this campus, which has recovered so heroically from natural disaster, something we Louisianians understand. Well, we understand natural disaster, not necessarily quick recovery. I'll be speaking this morning, I say this to those of you who came last night, about political philosophy, not about theology, though we can talk about the differences during the question period later on. So let me start. Have you ever had a favorite product that was dropped by its manufacturer? A favorite restaurant that was closed? A favorite song that fell off the charts and so off the playlist? What's wrong with me, perhaps you wondered, that I can't anticipate popular taste? Or if you're like me, you wondered what's wrong with the world that they can't appreciate what's good? This is rather the way I felt when I discovered that in revising his political philosophy, the well-known Harvard political philosopher John Rawls effectively discarded what he had called in his theory of justice the Aristotelian principle. To me, this had been the one redeeming feature in 587 pages, the place where Rawls's intuitions about justice seemed really true to experience, or at any rate, to my experience. Indeed, it seems to me that the Aristotelian principle was not an afterthought or dispensable feature of Rawls's celebrated theory, but essential to its integrity and plausibility. Technically, Rawls doesn't repute the Aristotelian principle in the revised version of his theory as it appears in his later book, Political Liberalism. He mentions it once in a summary of his earlier thought and once in a footnote. But it does no serious work in the new version, where the emphasis is no longer on justice as a comprehensive moral doctrine, but on what Rawls calls public reason, a set of restraints on political speech said to be necessary to ensure that citizens do not force their beliefs upon others, but operating in fact to privilege a certain form of secularist liberalism against real alternative communities of moral understanding. The abandonment of the Aristotelian principle is symptomatic of the problem with Rawls's later theory, its abstraction from real views of justice, and its consequent suppression of serious alternative voices and ideas. I do not know whether Robert George admired the Aristotelian principle in Rawls's theory of justice. There's extensive discussion of Aristotle in his Making Men Moral, and a considered critique, and extensive discussion of Rawls too, and again a considered critique. But I find no mention of Rawls's Aristotelian principle, nor in his subsequent criticism of Rawls's later work. But I intend in this paper to recommend the Aristotelian principle, abandoned by Rawls, might be adopted by Professor George, and to suggest that doing so might strengthen his case for public morality by reinforcing it with an Aristotelian buttress of public culture. Let me start by talking about Rawls's original theory. For those unfamiliar with his original work, and for those to whom it is a distant memory, allow me to summarize and recall its major points to put a so-called Aristotelian principle in context. I promise I'll tell you what it is. Barely a decade after the celebrated Locke scholar Peter Laslett pronounced political philosophy to be dead, Rawls published to great acclaim his synthetic account of a liberal philosophy of justice. Incorporating social science and game theory, as well as psychology and other branches of learning, Rawls revived the notion of a social contract to develop a rights-based philosophy of justice that aimed at once to capture the basic moral intuitions shared in liberal democracies and to formulate these in such a way as to structure a course of reasoning that would settle controversies and provide not only a platform for political reform, but an underlying constitutional doctrine that might define the outer boundaries of political dispute. Rawls's intuition was that, despite widespread pluralism in modern civil society, the philosopher could work out common principles of justice to which the whole society might subscribe. His first move was to distinguish between two kinds of goods. Basic goods are the things that everyone wants, no matter what else he wants, and other goods, which vary for different individuals according to the different things they value and their different plans of life. His second move was to specify a situation for choosing principles of justice which he dubbed the original position. What would people hold to be just if they knew nothing about the talents they would possess and the interests they would assume in their actual lives, but had to consider justice wholly apart from any knowledge of their personal self-interest that might bias their judgment? Rawls answers that people would choose his two principles of justice as fairness. That's his, how he describes his theory, justice as fairness. And he says it involves two principles. First, all would insist upon equality in the distribution of the basic goods, of rights and liberties, powers and opportunities, and the social bases of self-respect, he says. And second, they would allow inequalities in the distribution of other things, only to the extent that such inequalities serve to raise the level of the least advantaged members of society. As an example of the second principle, which he calls the difference principle, higher incomes could be justified for doctors and drug manufacturers, provided that the sick or chronically ill receive a net benefit from attracting more ambitious and so presumably more able people into medicine. Voluminous commentary quickly erupted concerning every aspect of Rawls's theory outlined here. Suffice it to say that Rawls assumed people to be risk averse but benefit hungry, putting pressure on both principles, equal rights and the difference principle, and probably permitting a sort of rough equilibrium between them in application. Rawls insisted that the first principle be honored before compromises intrinsic to the second could be made. Equal rights, equal opportunity, and equal respect had to come first in any society, said Rawls. But if these were secure, then people could strive to differentiate themselves. Translated into practical American terms, this meant that constitutional law had to be given priority in its protection of equal rights. Legislation permitting or even encouraging differentiation would naturally result from the clash of real interests all the time, but it could be justified if things improved for the worst off. In the 1970s, when the book appeared, it might have seemed that the difference principle excused extensive redistribution of social wealth. But after the 1980s and 1990s, a couple decades of free market experimentation during which entrepreneurial initiative spurred innovation with widespread gains in efficiency and especially technological advances that benefited even the least advantaged, most would agree, the difference principle might seem rather to explain than to attack the distribution of social wealth that results from the market. Rawls insisted that his account was deontological, not utilitarian. Abstract justice was shown to be obligatory on its own terms, not for the consequences it generates. So no potential benefits could abrogate adherence to basic rights. But he also meant to be realistic and even enthusiastic about genuine progress. In short, he married insistent moralism on the question of rights to pragmatism on the question of development. In fact, both Friedrich Hayek and James Buchanan, noted free market economists, saw Rawls's theory as potentially compatible with their own, and, at least until the present crisis, mainstream liberals who had made their peace with the market seemed willing to interpret the difference principle to allow extensive inequality of income or wealth. Rawls elaborates the outlines of his theory in the first part of The Theory of Justice, and in the second, he shows how it effectively reproduces American constitutionalism, at least in an age of a vigilant liberal judiciary. In the third and final part of that first book, Rawls undertakes to show that the society built upon such a theory could be stable and successful. In other words, while the device of the original position ensured that the two principles of justice were chosen because they were right, not for the sake of personal interest, the principles would come to be seen by their subscribers as genuinely good as well as right, as fully in their interest, too. Key to the argument is what he termed the Aristotelian principle, and he defined it as follows. This is a quotation. Other things equal, human beings enjoy the exercise of their realized capacities, that is, their innate or trained abilities, and this enjoyment increases the more the capacity is realized, or the greater its complexity. Taken by itself, the Aristotelian principle is, says Rawls, a principle of motivation or a psychological law, not a moral imperative, but a natural fact, an observation about the way people typically act. But what is really interesting is what, or at least to me, is what Rawls calls the companion effect of the Aristotelian principle. Although Rawls asserts, as Aristotle never would, that, quote, as citizens, we are to reject the standard of perfection as a political principle. For the purposes of justice, avoid any assessment, and for the purposes of justice, avoid any assessment of the relative value of one another's way of life. Still, Rawls allows that we enjoy the exercise not only of our own talents and capacities, but those of our companions. Indeed, it's precisely this that knits human beings together in what Rawls terms a social union. Let me quote at some length. One basic characteristic of human beings is that no one person can do everything he might do. In parenthesis, I don't think Professor Rawls knew Professor George at the time, but who's a banjo player as well as a philosopher, but of this more, he still doesn't play football like others in his family, so at least as far as I know. Let me go back. One characteristic of human beings is that no one person can do everything he might do, nor a fortiori, can he do everything that any other person can do. The potentialities of each individual are greater than those he can hope to realize, and they fall far short of the powers among men generally. Thus, everyone must select which of his abilities and possible interests he wishes to encourage. He must plan their training and exercise, and schedule their pursuit in an orderly way. Different persons with similar or complementary capacities may cooperate, so to speak, in realizing their common or matching nature. When men are secure in the enjoyment of the exercise of their own powers, they are disposed to appreciate the perfection of others, especially when their several excellences have an agreed place in a form of life, the aims of which all accept, end quotation. Behind the veil of ignorance, then, for Rawls, men decide upon principles of justice, thinking only of their own interests, which they do not know and thus must handle differently. Coming out from behind the veil, living in a society informed by justice and thus allowing all to develop while leaving no one in a worse way, people learn to take pleasure in one another and in one another's achievements. Precisely while allowing a choice of life plans according to each person's exercise of his reason, despite or even because of differences in what people consider to be good, a great community is formed that makes justice not only a duty, but something choice-worthy as a common good. As Rawls concludes, quote, the collective activity of justice is the preeminent form of human flourishing. Now, I want to make three observations about Rawls's use of the Aristotelian principle in the theory of justice. First, as I said at the outset, I think that Rawls's account of the Aristotelian principle, and particularly of its companion effect, observing that we often find our own inchoate capacities fulfilled through others, so that we can identify with others and so feel ourselves a part of society as a whole and appreciative of the justice that binds it together. I think this rings true to experience. This is what it means to live within a culture and to have a stake in its goodness and its strength. Second, I think Rawls overstates or misinterprets what he calls, quote, the acceptance of democracy in the assessment of one another's excellences. Democratic justice requires equal respect for persons, but one can distinguish persons from their choices and pursuits. Precisely if we have a stake in one another's fulfillment of our talents, we cannot remain indifferent to the choices people make, nor be debarred from offering or immune from receiving criticism for the use to which we put our skills. The development of any talent requires initiative on the part of the person, and that's one reason why, on the whole, people have the right to make their own choices about how to live, and why they experience the very act of choosing as a good. But development also requires counsel and guidance, and to the extent that Rawls discourages these, I think he errs. Third point, the companion effect of the Aristotelian principle makes sense of the assumption embedded in the original position that persons can be imagined apart from their personal capacities. That, in other words, they do not own their own talents in the same way that they own their basic liberties. There is a social dimension, thinks Rawls, to the talent pool. That is, as I just noted, only part of the story, For no talent gets developed unless a person takes ownership of its formation. But as allowed by Rawls's notion of reflective equilibrium, if individuals can be persuaded that their own talents and those of others are best developed in a just society, as he describes it, they might agree to cede their natural claim of right as to their own gifts, or rather to their natural reward for those gifts, as the original position demands of them. At least it makes Rawls's theory itself coherent and plausible, and the sharing in one another's talents, captured by the Aristotelian principle, allowed a Rawlsian to critique a libertarian theory that gives individuals absolute ownership of everything about themselves. Next section of my talk is called Rawls's Revision, his book Political Liberalism. When Rawls rewrote his theory of justice in Political Liberalism, however, he abandoned the effort originally made in part three of A Theory of Justice to show that justice's fairness is not only right, but good. Rawls accepted criticism made of his initial theory that he underestimated the depth of reasonable pluralism in modern society and overestimated the extent of overlapping consensus among those with different commitments and points of view. More precisely, he claims now to recognize that, quote, modern democratic society is characterized not simply by a pluralism of comprehensive religious, philosophical, and moral doctrines, but a pluralism of incompatible yet reasonable comprehensive doctrines. Whereas justice's fairness was defended in A Theory of Justice as exactly such a comprehensive doctrine, precisely the point of part three was to prove its comprehensiveness. Rawls, in the later book, retreats to offering justice's fairness as a kind of meta-doctrine, able, or proto-doctrine, I'm not quite sure which one, able in theory to attract more adherents because it claims only to go as far as the overlapping consensus on right, without making the further claim to be not only right, but also good. While the Aristotelian principle would still matter to the comprehensive liberal, in American society, this type must share governance with various other comprehensive doctrinaires, most notably the religious, who have different ideas about ultimate goodness and may not consider the society where various talents are respected and developed to satisfy their yearning for justice and the good, according to Rawls. It's enough, Rawls thinks in his later work, if a sort of bare-bones liberalism can be developed that claims only to settle upon a political consensus, not promising mutual fulfillment, but only basic justice. The key concept in the revised theory, which Rawls calls, again, political liberalism, is the notion of public reason. In their debates over constitutional essentials and questions of basic justice, according to Rawls, citizens must not appeal, quote, to the whole truth as they see it, but only to such arguments as can be made, quote, in terms each could reasonably expect that others might endorse as consistent with their freedom and equality. In other words, in public, you can't speak a language that everyone won't agree to and understand. For example, unless the overlapping consensus in society included belief in God, maybe even belief according to the same faith, according to Rawls's notion of public reason, reference to God's will or law ought to be excluded from public debate. No one can reasonably expect the atheist to endorse an argument from divine authority. And even to make it, according to Rawls, is implicitly to exclude unbelievers from the debate. Professor George, among others, has subjected this concept to telling criticism, not least for excluding in practice, the reverse, excluding most religious citizens from playing a role in actual debates. Rawls claims that the theory of political liberalism is meant to allow for a deeper pluralism than his original theory. But in fact, it excludes most alternatives to liberalism at least as readily as the original, and moreover, does so by suppressing debate. I want to level two related criticisms at the idea of political liberalism itself. In the first place, while Rawls is correct to think that those who hold incompatible comprehensive doctrines can live together in peace only through political agreement, he errs to think that a philosophy based on overlapping consensus is the only or the soundest source of such agreement. In practice, plurality in our society is mediated by politics itself, at least as carried out within constitutional forms, not by philosophy. To try to substitute philosophy for politics is apt to confuse the one for the other, either substituting a political program for a philosophic quest, while perhaps not acknowledging that one has done so, or by imposing philosophic censorship on real political debate. To be sure, political pluralism is viable only where there is agreement on constitutional essentials, and can extend only to those who accept the constitutional framework. But there's no reason to think that, at least in the United States, constitutional agreement is not widespread and adequate without philosophical reduction. People of different religious or moral commitment can accept the constitutional framework for their own reasons. I'm sorry, let me put it this way. Can accept the same constitutional framework for their own, probably different reasons, and still act within it on the basis of the full range of their own beliefs. Part of what constitutional experience teaches is the need for coalition and compromise on most occasions to be able to assemble a winning coalition. This naturally requires political players to tailor their public speech so as not to offend or dissuade those whose partnership they seek. In other words, politics itself will lead people to limit what they say when they want to limit it to win, but it doesn't peremptorily shut them up. To impose such a peremptory or artificial limitation from outside on what they can say is, I think, to abridge their political freedom and, as a consequence, to reduce their commitment to the constitutional order, which they might come to see as broadly incompatible with their own comprehensive views. Indeed, freedom of conscience requires that people be left to their own ultimate commitments, and thus to their own reasons and justifications, even for their shared adherence to the constitutional order. Although they are likely to differ somewhat in their interpretation of the Constitution in light of their different ways of grounding it, there's no reason a priori to assume that such differences cannot be settled politically, even by an agreement to disagree. Rather than to stand in need of a philosophy like Rawls's political liberalism that can in principle settle their disputes without asking them their opinion. In the second place, Rawls's move towards political liberalism betrays not so much his discovery of pluralism as his loss of faith in the Aristotelian principle. After all, differences in comprehensive doctrines might be rooted in part in differences in men's faculties as well as in their traditions, and thus might have proven acceptable within the confines of justice as fairness through its Aristotelian principle. If men can take pleasure in each other's talents in such a way that a world is knit together by their shared or overlapping or sometimes oppositional choices, why can the same not be true where the differences are matters of comprehensive doctrine, not just differences based on talent? In other words, if a society where individuals have different life plans might nevertheless come to appreciate the differences and recognize a basis for stability even in their very disagreements, why is stability impossible where comprehensive liberals, Catholics, evangelical Christians, and Jews can work out political solutions while respecting one another's differences and even seeing in the differences an intimation of transcendent good? Rawls rejects his older attempt in Part 3 of A Theory of Justice to endorse an account of a well-ordered society on the grounds that it's unrealistic in its own terms, seeking one comprehensive doctrine of justice for a world where, given human diversity, one would indeed expect many incompatible yet reasonable comprehensive doctrines. But why isn't it enough that justice as fairness liberalism know its own mind, offering a comprehensive account to those in search of one, and coming to terms politically with those who cannot in good conscience fully share its assumptions? After all, there's no talent czar in Rawls's earlier theory, but instead a chance for individuals to put themselves forward and make what they will of what others do and think. What is unrealistic in the new theory is the assumption that the same people who differ on fundamental things will have a sufficient overlapping consensus to formulate shared principles beyond those built into the Constitution and the agreed upon forms of politics, at least sufficient to allow the replacement of ordinary politics with the fiat of some professor or of a Supreme Court, the latter of which Rawls dubs an exemplar of public reason, a phrase that sends a chill down my spine. My last section is called Public Morality and Political Culture. I suggested at the outset that if John Rawls has abandoned the Aristotelian principle, as I now have shown he has, perhaps the concept could be adopted by Professor George and used to help construct a defense of law and legislation that protects public morality. Given constraints of time, let me only sketch. The Aristotelian principle takes into account human difference and illustrates that far from being a cause of trouble, plurality in capacities is a source of enjoyment and fulfillment. This is familiar, I argue, because we know that human beings are naturally oriented to culture. The Aristotelian principle explains why. Does the same argument apply to public morality or moral culture? At first glance, this might seem unlikely. Public morality is usually defended as a necessary support for equal rights and equal dignity, and seems not to have anything to do with a culture based on talent. But consider the companion effect. If living and acting together, human beings enhance one another by the fulfillment of their talents in a way that others can share and enjoy, so perhaps the abuse of capacities likewise degrades not only the person who wastes or buries his talents, but also other companions who are both deprived of the benefit of others' excellences and demoralized by their friends' depravity. To be sure, as there is an individual dimension to the development of talent, so there is individual resistance to social decay. But as Professor George has shown, the case for public morality does not require universal application, only widespread need. The Aristotelian principle shows that human beings are happier the more they exercise their capacities and the more complex their exercises. Is it not a corollary, then, that the road to misery comes from enervation and reduction? And cannot most offenses against public morals, precisely because they are self-destructive, be shown to be one or the other of these? Now, to make the case that Professor George should adopt the Aristotelian principle, I want to be clear that I'm not trying to sell it to him, just to sort of lay it out. One has to ask, of course, how would this orphan fit into his philosophical household? So I'm obliged briefly to describe that. It is, as you can imagine, a very different home than Rawls's. There are no devices like the veil of ignorance in making men moral, and the notion of ideal theory or the four-stage sequence, but instead an unwavering insistence upon reasoning about the human good, or rather human goods as these are known and experienced. Nor are the goods divided into the basic goods and individual preferences as they are in Rawls, though they are distinguished into substantive goods, which he lists as life itself, knowledge, play, and aesthetic experience, and reflexive goods, that is, goods where the choice of the goods is part of what makes them good. And these, among these, he includes sociability or friendship, practical reasonableness, and religion. Professor George inherited this list of goods from his teacher, John Finnis, and they've since added an eighth intrinsic good, if I understand this correctly, an eighth intrinsic good to their list, namely marriage, which I assume is reflexive because constituted by the party's consent. These goods are, writes Professor George, intrinsic and constitutive aspects of complete human well-being and fulfillment. And with the exception of the latecomer marriage, the original seven, are all of them evident in some degree and kind in every human life. In describing what is good in this way, Professor George embraces what he calls the central tradition of philosophical ethics and politics. As human beings aim to be happy, to make these goods their own, so associations of people, and in particular the polity or state, aim to coordinate the strivings of all, but also share in their aspiration that men be happy and good. Where Professor George modifies the tradition is in recognizing the enormous plurality in how people act out the seven goods, what kind of knowledge they pursue, what play they enjoy, what friends they choose, what religion they submit to, and so forth. And thus he rejects the idea, apparent at least in Aristotle and maybe still in Aquinas, that there is so clear a hierarchy of goods that there ought to result a hierarchy of persons. In rejecting the tradition's idea of natural claims to rule, this hierarchy of persons, and in celebrating the enormous, and I suppose one should say humanly incomprehensible variety of plurality of goods, Professor George aligns himself with liberalism, at least in its classical formulation. More precisely, he preserves the mansion of liberal civil society, but places it upon a new, or really very old, foundation, not the social contract, as in Hobbes, Locke, or Rawls, but a foundation of intrinsic human good, previously the ground of less liberal republics or even monarchies. In Louisiana, we would say he moved the house out of the flood zone or raised it up. He saves from liberalism not only plurality and freedom, but also a structure of civil liberties. But again, these are given new grounding. Modern liberals like Rawls start with a presumption of human autonomy, that individuals are creators of value and laws to themselves. That's why, like the hairstylist Professor Carey referred to last night, that's why they can't explain something so simple and obvious as the need to suppress the grosser forms of vice, to lessen the opportunity for corruption and provide a decent environment for true human striving. Professor George, with a robust notion of human good, confidently swats the pests. But his challenge, then, is to explain the constitutional liberties that we inherit and experience as good, but that were not recognized as such by Aristotle and Aquinas. This he does in the final chapter of Making Men Moral, and I heartily recommend it to you. Freedom of speech, and also of the press and assembly, is defended or are defended as the freedom to reason and to cooperate in the giving of reasons, both deliberatively and dialectically. It's broad enough to welcome the expression of feelings as well as the giving of reasons, not least because in governance, widespread feelings, however irrational, cannot be ignored. In a particularly brilliant passage, he defends the right of privacy. Did I say Professor George defends the right of privacy? Yes, Professor George defends the right of privacy as the obverse of free speech, not right of privacy as a right to do anything you want with yourself or anyone attached to you, but as a protection of interiority against the glare of the forum, a protection needed by the individual for his thoughts and by families and other associations for the sake of developing their lives together. Finally, he defends freedom of religion, following Finnis and others, defining the good of religion in terms that include even the atheist, as the quest for an ultimate intelligible reason for action, and as something that can be authentic only if it's freely chosen, not coerced. Now, where does the Aristotelian principle fit in this framework? I imagine Professor George would say, it's already there, in the plurality of the good, in the good of sociability, and in the attention paid to the need for cooperation in all human activity, and especially in governance. Aristotle, after all, was the grandfather of the central tradition that Professor George means to keep. But while I agree that the household ought to be welcoming to Rawls's abandoned principle, I think the question of emphasis might still reflect a question of substance, and one with no small implication for how we argue about morality in public today. Rawls's Aristotelian principle draws attention to the strivings of ambition in our society, to the energy devoted to the cultivation of talent, often competitively, and suggests how all this competition for fulfillment, the pursuit of happiness, as it were, ultimately should result in the flourishing of a shared culture. I said I thought the observation true about the pleasure we take in each other's excellences, but it would be perverse to suggest that this striving for shared culture tends by some sort of invisible hand always to the good. On the contrary, the state of our culture, compared to others of not so distant memory, is, if not wholly degraded, at least generally mediocre. Well, the cultivation of science is now a beautifully well-honed machine, but advanced science in the midst of decayed culture is a recipe for disaster, as the totalitarian experiments of the 20th century clearly showed. What I want to suggest is that the full project of making men happy by making them moral needs to integrate the moral insights of the central tradition into a full account of modern society and economy that explains their interdependence. Rawls's Aristotelian principle seems to me to have been an attempt to do just that. And I think it was the breadth of Rawls's philosophical ambition that earned his first book its reputation, and that makes it a double shame that in the second book, Political Liberalism, Rawls pulled back to the small-minded and censorious. My question about whether Professor George would adopt the Aristotelian principle is, I suppose, a challenge to step into the vacuum, not only to defend morality in an often hostile world, but to integrate moral insight into a comprehensive account of human economy, society, and polity. I mean, he can write another book if he has the time and desire. He doesn't have to do this on the spot. Thank you.